Welcome to the Resolving Violence Podcast, created to deliver current Canadian prairie-based research on violence and abuse to service providers, people with lived experience, and the general public. I'm Jordan, and if you'd like to learn more about factors that influence violence and the ways you can address them, let's get started.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of the Resolving Violence Podcast. This week, I'll be interviewing our very own Ariana Gibson. Outside of being one of Resolving Violence's hosts, Ariana is currently finishing up her first year of graduate training in clinical psychology at the University of Saskatchewan, alongside working as a research assistant for Resolve Saskatchewan. Ariana's current research focus is on the experiences of parents with borderline personality disorder, with aims of elucidating what this phase of life is like for these individuals and empowering them in navigating these roles. She's also been working on research and program development aimed at the indigenization and decolonization of psychology education and mental health professional training in line with truth and reconciliation efforts in Canada. Ariana's previous research was focused on mental illness stigma and microaggressions, which will be what we're discussing in today's episode. So I hope you can enjoy. All right. Well, I feel kind of silly saying welcome to the podcast, given that you're one of the main hosts, but you're a guest today. So welcome to the podcast, Ariana. Thank you for joining me today. We're here to talk about some of the work you've been doing as a graduate student in clinical psychology, namely a study you led on the relationship between familiarity, relationship quality, and stigma around mental illness. So I'd like to start us off by talking a little about what the study actually was. So first, there's a lot of terminology used in stigma research, like prejudice, stereotypes, discrimination, microaggressions, and more. Just to help orient our audience, could you start us off by explaining some of the differences between these terms?
Yeah, thank you, Shaylin. I'm excited to be the one who's getting asked the questions this time. With regards to defining these terms, I'll start by saying that there generally isn't a huge consensus on how we define all of these terms. And so if you were to read a study on stigma, chances are you may read something slightly different from what I'm saying now. However, stigma is a really expansive process with a lot of moving parts, many of which don't often get spoken about. So I do think it's important to dive into this to really set the stage. So this study was my honors project, and the conceptualization of stigma that we used in my honors lab is largely based on how it is proposed by Link and Fellin, who are two pretty prominent names in this area of research. And so they characterize stigma as a process. And the outcomes of that process are things like prejudice and discrimination. So we have the process and then we have the outcomes. And so overall, stigma is when we distinguish and label human differences in a way that dominant cultural beliefs are denoted as desirable and non-dominant beliefs or appearance or identities are thought to be undesirable. And this leads to things like status loss and unequal outcomes, which can be further propelled by having a lack of power, whether that be social, economic, or political power. So really, this conceptualization leans on that power and difference and how that differential maintains the separation of people. So at risk of getting a little technical, stigma can also be divided into different types. The big ones being public stigma, which is what my study was focused on, as well as structural stigma and self-stigma. So public stigma is really just how it occurs between people, and structural being that more systemic level where things like policy can exacerbate or evoke stigma. And then self-stigma is how those beliefs can be internalized within the targets of the stigma. And so it's really important to note that these have a transactional nature. So they're really all feeding into one another in a sort of cycle. So, as I said, there's a lot to get into with all these terms. So going back to the other terms I mentioned, stigma has negative outcomes, which includes stereotypes, prejudice, and discrimination. So stereotypes are generally viewed as the thoughts or cognitions related to stigma. And then prejudice is that feelings piece. So when you're having those stereotypical thoughts about a person or a group, what feelings is that evoking in you? And then we have discrimination, which is the behavioral piece. After you have those thoughts and those feelings, how are you acting that then may be perpetuating stigma? So an example looking at mental illness would be, I think people with mental illness are dangerous. That would be the stereotype. And that makes me scared, which is the prejudice. And so, because in this fictitious scenario, I'm going to be a landlord, I'm not going to rent the apartment to somebody with a mental illness. And unfortunately, that's a really common reality that we see when it comes to stigma towards those with a mental illness. And there's one really important piece that I've left out here that is critical to my study, and that's microaggressions. So this term was originally coined in the 1970s, mostly in relation to things like race and gender, and that's probably the context that most people have heard about it in. Microaggressions in relation to mental illness, that literature didn't really start coming out until about 2015. So it's fairly new. And so microaggressions are those everyday slights and insults that may be verbal or nonverbal, and intentional or not, they are ultimately communicating hostile, derogatory, or negative messages to the person that it's targeted at. And the key thing with microaggressions that differentiate it from what I was talking about previously is they tend to be really covert and ambiguous. So the target is often left really confused, but still distressed because of the deniability of the act. You know, people might say like, oh, like I didn't mean it that way, but it still was harmful in the way that they said it. So because of the subtleties that are characteristic of microaggressions, they serve to diminish people over time through repeated subtle exclusions. So where something like discrimination has an evident impact, like not having a home, microaggressions tend to gradually take away people's autonomy and isolate them further and further over time because they are so subtle.
Thank you for that thorough response. My own research interests are related to social narratives and mental frameworks and how people come to interpret the world around them. So this is sort of tangentially an interest of mine, but since I don't come from like a clinical psychology background, it's really fascinating to hear about the nuances and how these terms are used and like what actually does differentiate them. Since for people that have less experience, I imagine the terms get conflated a lot and people treat them like synonyms.
Yeah.
So there's a particular theory of stigma that you were interested in exploring. Could you walk us through that?
Yeah, absolutely. So this theory was proposed by Patrick Corrigan and one of his grad students, and it's looking at the relationship between public stigma and familiarity, with familiarity just being the closeness between people. And so they suggested a U-shaped trend, which was pretty exciting because generally this had been thought to follow a more linear trend in this context. And so apologies, this will be a little bit difficult to explain without the visual graph that they use to kind of depict their theory. So I'll do my best for audio listeners to make this make sense. But so basically, if you imagine a graph, on the y-axis, there would be public stigma. So that's that vertical axis. And then on the x-axis or the horizontal axis, you would have familiarity. And so if you picture a U shape on that graph, on the left side of the U, you have people like strangers, acquaintances, coworkers, and people like that. And then at the bottom of the U, you have extended family members. And on the right side of the U shape, you have immediate family, spouses, as well as mental health service providers because they have such an intimate knowledge of you. So essentially, this means that at the lowest and at the highest points of familiarity, this theory proposes that there will also be the highest amount of stigma towards mental illness. And then at the midpoint of familiarity, which is that extended family group, you would have the lowest amount of stigma. So hopefully all of that made sense.
I think so. I think I'm following so far.
Great. Okay. So, and some of the reasons that they suggest that we have this trend in stigma is due to things like the concealability of mental illness. So your immediate family members are more likely to be exposed to the more difficult aspects of the disorder and therefore experience things like caregiver burden, which can then exacerbate stigma. Whereas on the low end, because knowledge of mental illness is found to be a kind of a protective factor against stigma, when you have someone like a stranger who may not know anything about mental illness, then they also exhibit that increase in stigma. Of course, there's a lot more that goes into that, but that's the general idea of that theory. And then another important thing to note is that this theory does not actually account for microaggressions. And so one finding in the mental illness microaggression literature is that they are found to be higher in people that you are closer with. And so naturally, I saw a connection there and wanted to explore that as well.
So how did you explore that? Like, what was your actual methodology for this study?
This was an experimental study. So it gets a little technical, but so it was a 2x3 factorial design, which essentially just means there were 6 different conditions that I was randomly assigning people into. And in those 6 conditions, the participants read a vignette that I created. So basically just like a little story. And that story depicted an individual with depression and anxiety. And depending on the condition, that person was depicted as either a coworker of the participant, a cousin, or a romantic partner. So that's how we manipulated familiarity. And if you think back to that explanation of the you that I described, that then gets at somebody on the left side, somebody at that bottom point, and then somebody on the right side. And then the vignettes also manipulated relationship quality. So the relationships were either depicted as being positive or negative. And then after reading the vignette, the participants did a measure of mental illness stigma and a measure of mental illness microaggressions, so we could assess how much they endorse these attitudes towards the character. And then, of course, we ultimately wanted to know if familiarity and relationship quality played a part in the endorsement of those attitudes.
Okay. So what were your biggest findings or the things that surprised you the most or you thought were the most interesting to come out of this experiment?
Yeah, so when I ran the analyses, I did a separate analysis for stigmatizing attitudes and one for microaggressions. For all the stats people out there, I did a factorial and COVA to determine the differences among the conditions. And then I also did polynomial contrast, which are basically just used to assess the trends in the data. So with that, I was trying to determine if there were differences among the groups, and then did they follow the same U-shaped trend that was proposed in the theory, or was it linear or something different? And so what we found is that for stigma, relationship quality significantly impacted stigma, but familiarity did not. And then for microaggressions, familiarity significantly impacted it, but relationship quality did not. And so then when it came to the contrast, which looked at the trends, we actually didn't have any significant findings that supported the U-shaped trend for stigma. I will say that the numerical differences between them, though they were not significant, they kind of like subtly followed that shape. So it could just be that the way that I decided to test it couldn't accurately pick up on those differences. But for microaggressions, what was really surprising is that it actually was in the opposite direction. It was more of an N shape, a lowercase n, instead of a U. So it was actually that moderate familiarity group, the cousins, that had the highest amount of microaggressions, and then coworkers had the lowest. And then it actually seemed like once there was at least a moderate level of familiarity, the microaggression endorsement kind of leveled out. So it was similarly pretty high for the romantic partner condition as well. And yeah, I just thought that was super interesting because it was really not what we expected.
That does sound interesting, specifically the idea of it being almost the inverse, like going from the U shape to the N shape, depending on which quality you were studying.
Yeah.
So if those are your findings, what would you say are the takeaways for this? Like, what would you want people to be aware of when they're coming away from having heard about this study?
Yeah, so when it comes to the implications of this, from a theoretical standpoint, these findings suggest that microaggressions and stigmatizing attitudes are functionally different from each other based on the fact that they were differentially impacted by different aspects of relationships. And this was a big deal to me personally, because I had come across a few studies that were kind of criticizing the idea of microaggressions and suggesting that it's just like a less severe form of stigma and not really its own separate idea. And my study kind of supports the idea that it is, and that it's functionally impacted differently depending on the context. So that was really interesting. And then from a clinical perspective, this tells us that when clients are in negative relationships, regardless of whether it's their parent, their spouse, their friend, their coworker, whoever, then they are more likely to experience more overt stigma. But with close relationships in particular, they might be hearing things from like their spouse or their parent that deeply confuse and distress them, but they don't fully understand why, because those insults are so ambiguous. And I think that's really important to note in a clinical context, because it gives you an idea of what your clients might be experiencing and how stigma might be impacting their life.
I do find the functional difference you're describing between stigma and microaggressions interesting, since the language we use often colors how people perceive what is being described. And there's always a risk that when you use certain terminology, then it may almost come across as though you're softening or downplaying or drawing attention away from what is actually taking place. So
like you were saying, there has been some literature that suggests that it's just a lesser version or just a modified version of this. And so the clarification that you're potentially making here that no, it's its own distinct thing and it should be addressed. That seems really significant.
Yeah, absolutely.
So you were talking about kind of your personal feelings on the area. And I'm curious, why is stigma an area of interest for you when it comes to research?
Yeah, absolutely. So there are two big reasons why researching stigma and reducing it are really important to me. The first being that I have personal experience with stigma. And if you remember, I mentioned earlier that piece about self-stigma and how these beliefs can be internalized. And I have experienced that firsthand, and it is a really confusing time because you think you know who you are, but then the world beyond you says something else, and those things start to get muddled together, and you start to believe what other people say about you. And now, coming from the perspective of someone who is undergoing clinical training, I have witnessed how stigmatizing beliefs are further perpetuated in the field. And in saying that, I don't want to place blame on any individual service provider, but rather highlight that as psychologists, we are socialized in a way that perpetuates these beliefs. And these attitudes and beliefs then impact our work, which then impacts our clients. And yeah, so all that to say, I just have really seen the pervasiveness of stigma from both sides. And I really believe that it is critical that we have directed efforts to correct some of these misplaced ideas about the individuals who do have a mental illness.
So there are some schools of thought that suggest that stigma regarding things like mental illness can be a risk factor for violence. So in like super simplistic terms, basically that if there is an impression that having mental illness or having some sort of, I don't know, neurodivergence means that you are a dangerous or unsafe person, then others respond with greater negativity or greater hostility. So is this an idea that you've encountered in your research? Do you have any thoughts on this potential link?
Yeah, so I do have a few thoughts. I'll start by saying this isn't something I'm as well versed in. My two areas of research interest, stigma and violence, are still pretty separate in my brain, but I do have some thoughts about the connections between them. So as you said, when we're talking about violence and mental illness specifically, the way it is most often talked about is that people with mental illness are dangerous, and that is actually a big driver for the stigma of mental illness. It's actually usually, when you're looking at like measures of stigma of mental illness, it's usually dangerousness and social distance. So you believe they're dangerous, so you then distance yourself from them. And I think on that, I'd just like to say that yes, while in a minority of cases, individuals with mental illness can be violent or aggressive, this is not the majority of those individuals. And there are far more people with a mental illness who do not exhibit any aggressive behaviors, and that with treatment, these behaviors can be prevented. And I think that's what needs to be focused on. But to talk about violence and stigma more broadly, I'd say that as far as the research I've been exposed to goes, I've encountered stigma being a risk factor for violence more often when it comes to things other than mental illness. For example, stigma against sex workers can then result in violent behavior towards them, or stigma against LGBT plus individuals and the violence that results from that. So in that way, I think things like hate crimes really demonstrates this link between stigma and violence, and where it begins from this separation of us versus them, and then it builds and builds until it culminates in those aggressive acts towards the people that we have excluded from our in-group. And then yeah, when it comes to mental illness, I don't think we see hate crimes as frequently because a lot of the times it is a concealable identity. So if we wanted to talk about intersectionality, I think a lot of equity deserving groups, that is what I call marginalized groups, so as not to further marginalize them, they also end up having mental illness in part because of the discrimination that they've been exposed to. So in that way, I think it's hard to tease apart the mental illness aspect of it. And maybe that's why we don't see as much research on it. Overall, I do think that stigma can definitely drive violence in either direction in some cases.
Well, that's a lot of food for thought. Thank you. It's interesting hearing somebody that has expertise in this area share that expertise. I hear you talk and I go, huh, that's really interesting. That's a really good way of thinking about that. I kind of want to learn more about this.
Yeah.
And I guess that's part of what a podcast is for, is to like get that motivating spark going.
Yeah, absolutely.
Your study was at least partially about stigma that arises between people who are already familiar with each other. That's that familiarity piece. And research suggests that violence more often occurs in interpersonal relationships than it does between total strangers. So do you have any thoughts on how these patterns might compare to each other?
Yeah, so as I've mentioned a couple times, for mental illness, because it is a concealable identity, the individuals who know about it are likely those who are really close to that person. And if you are close with someone, you probably see them often. And so there's more opportunity for that stigma to occur. So you have both the knowledge of the mental illness as well as the opportunity to perpetrate it. And so, of course, if you think about violence and stigma, they're ultimately social experiences. Even if they're negative ones, you cannot perpetrate or be a victim of stigma or violence without that interpersonal connection. And yes, while these can be perpetrated against complete strangers, there's more opportunity for these acts to occur with someone you are seeing all the time. So I think exposure to that individual alone is a huge reason that we see violence increased in close relationships. And then thinking about intimate partner violence more specifically, while I'm new to this area of research, so take what I say with a grain of salt, the closeness of relationships offers a way to conceal the identity or to conceal the intimate partner violence as well. So in an IPV situation, those people are likely within their own home. And I can imagine that individuals who have a proclivity towards violence are more likely to act out where they are unlikely to be caught rather than, say, out in public where they could be identified and charged. And I think that the likeliness of the victim coming forward also plays a part in that. So whereas a stranger has no reason to protect you and no real obligation to you, someone in a close interpersonal relationship probably does. And I know this was spoken about on at least one previous episode, but, you know, we really have to remember that when it comes to IPV, that relationship likely started with love. And while there are like multiple reasons that mostly women stay in these relationships, the fact that the relationship was good at one point is undeniably one of them. And so then the longer you're in that situation, the more opportunity there is. And yeah, so that's kind of where I see the familiarity piece kind of playing a role in those increased statistics.
So to close us off, based on your knowledge and expertise in the area of stigma, and since we've sort of found our winding way back to the topic of violence, if you were to give a service provider who works directly with populations at risk of experiencing or using violence a practice to work toward in the long term or something simple they can begin implementing today, what would that be?
So I think all of my recommendations are both long-term and short-term. And this made me feel for all of the previous guests, this is a really hard question to answer. I was like, wow.
I always feel bad when I ask it because like I know we're putting a lot on you. Like, go ahead and fix it. Tell us how to fix it.
Yes. But so I will try my best. But yeah, so these are all things that you can start doing today, but will inevitably require a consistent effort on the part of clinicians, I think. And really, I think when we're talking about stigma, which like encompasses things like racism, sexism, and all of those big isms, that's always going to be something that's going to take a lot of effort to achieve in reducing. So keep that in mind. We are all human at the end of the day, and every effort matters. But so first, I would recommend making yourself more aware of the literature on stigma. I know for me personally, had I not done my honors in this area, I would know very little about what the research says because it really isn't something that is sufficiently covered in undergraduate education in psychology or graduate training even, which I'm just in my first year, so maybe I will come across it later in my graduate training, but it's not talked about enough in my opinion. And so, yeah, the reason I say this is there is so much more to stigma than I think people realize, especially that of microaggressions. Yeah, it's just a substantial area of research that I think most people don't get exposed to. And actually, on the topic of microaggressions, it has actually been coined the modern form of discrimination. So like we're seeing a lot more of these covert acts that are harder to pinpoint. So I think it's really important that clinicians educate themselves on what these can look like so we can help to reduce them. So there's a lot of ways that we subtly endorse stigma that you can't really acknowledge in yourself until you've educated yourself. I know that one thing that I've come across, my dissertation research is focused on parents with borderline personality disorder. And I have found, I'm doing a systematic review right now, and I found in my screening that the way that people with BPD are spoken about in the literature is very harmful. Saying things like the difficult patient, like I personally really don't think that there's a reason to use terminology like that. And I think as a field, we can do better in how we talk about our clients. And this segues really well into my next recommendation, which is to recognize how you speak or think about your clients when they aren't in front of you. Are you still showing that unconditional positive regard? Are you holding on to some harmful beliefs? This is something that takes a conscious effort, and it is okay if you still hold on to some of those beliefs because we are socialized to have them. It's really quite impossible to escape having been exposed to these. But the important thing is that you're recognizing it, you're correcting it, noticing that if you wouldn't want them to hear you saying it, you should assess whether it is perpetuating a stigmatizing belief or not. And then lastly, this recommendation kind of plays into all of the other ones, but it's a bit easier to accomplish. So changing your language to being more person-centered. And one specific example I have of this is separating the person from the mental illness. So rather than saying a mentally ill person, saying a person with a mental illness. This helps to reduce stigma in the sense that it reminds us that they are a whole person beyond their mental illness. And a mental illness is not a defining feature. It is not the only thing that makes a person. And I think that's one simple thing that we can do to support these individuals and empower them and hopefully reduce both stigma and violence along the way.
Thank you so much for that. We were laughing about how difficult this question can be to answer, but those are some really clear and concrete like suggestions for directions people can take, especially the last bit about language and remembering to center the person so that you're not unintentionally dehumanizing by mm-hmm. focusing too much on the clinical aspect of it. Mm-hmm. I also think that the emphasis you placed on consistency is probably pretty critical. Like even the best effort, if it's just a one-off, if it's just one thing that you're doing once or twice or only within a short window of time, then it's only going to be as good as long as it's being implemented. And experiences of violence or experiences with mental illness or any sort of issue that people may be trying to address, it can have far-reaching impacts that bleed into all other aspects of a person's life or a person's environment. And consistency and ongoing repetition and reinforcement, that can be so important to make sure that people aren't getting lost or being overlooked.
Yeah, absolutely. I appreciate that insight.
Well, thank you so much for joining me today, Ariana. I feel like I've learned a lot. I'm hoping that our listeners feel the same way. I just wanted to check in. Did you have any final thoughts that you wanted to share or final comments you want to make or words you want to leave people off with?
I don't think so at this point in time.
All right. Well, in that case, I hope it was fun for you to have a chance to be the one who was getting interviewed and had a chance to share instead of just being the interviewer. Thank you again so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you for joining us for another episode of Resolving Violence. If you're interested in learning more about today's guests and their research or Resolve Saskatchewan, please check the show notes below. And if what you listened to today was helpful, please consider sharing it with colleagues and on social media so we can work collectively to resolve violence. Thanks again. Until next time.